As a young man, California poet laureate Dana Gioia wanted to compose music before he discovered poetry's power and intimacy.
For me, the most delicious experience of poetry is when a friend will say, "Oh, here's a wonderful poem, let me read it to you." And it's the intimacy of communication, one voice to one listener, that is my favorite venue for poetry.
Poet and former NEA chairman Dana Gioia. He discusses his provocative essay book, Disappearing Ink, Poetry at the End of Print Culture, on the State Poets Laureate edition of New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. A self-described 100% non-Anglo of Mexican and Italian descent, Dana Gioia takes pride in his working-class upbringing in Los Angeles, which he left behind to earn 3 college degrees at Stanford and Harvard before rising in the business world to become vice president of General Foods Corporation. But business was never his first love. He left the corporate world to become a full-time writer in 1992, the publication year of his controversial book, Can Poetry Matter? Essays on Poetry and American Culture, which is featured in an earlier interview in our audio archives at newletters.org. Gioia won the 2002 American Book Award for his third poetry collection, Interrogations at Noon, which we'll hear today. Grey Wolf Press has gone on to publish 2 more of his poetry books, including 99 Poems, New and Selected, winner of the 2018 Poets Prize. Today we're looking back at his essay on being a California poet from his collection, Disappearing Ink. Quick note, Dana Gioia's term as California State Poet Laureate was from 2015 through 2018. But since the new governor still hasn't appointed anyone, Dana Gioia, who did readings with local poets in all 58 counties of his state, has continued to support initiatives such as Poetry Out Loud 2019. To give you more insight into his passion, here's Dana Gioia in a 2004 New Letters on the Air.
Nabokov once said that he saw no fundamental difference between poetry and what he called artistic prose. And I think at some level he's right. I mean, there's certain formal devices you use in poetry that you don't use in prose. But I've always been interested in the idea of using prose in a fundamentally poetic way to make a fundamentally prosaic point, and to use the power of image, of allusion, of sound to, as it were, carry an intellectual argument. And what this is about how odd it is to be a literary writer, a poet, and practice the strange art of poetry from the vantage point of California. It's called On Being a California Poet. A California poet almost inevitably feels the competing claims of language and experience. Here on the western edge of North America, we speak a European language that was transported centuries ago to a new continent. English is a northern tongue, born originally of Anglo-Saxon, Norman, French, and Norse. However rich its vocabulary with later overlays of Latin, Greek, and Italian, this island tongue was shaped in other latitudes. By the time it had moved westward to the Pacific, Spanish was already rooted in California, among the state's indigenous languages. New places and unfamiliar things had already been named, and those names have endured. This situation presents the poet with a paradox. Although English is our language, it remains at some deep level slightly foreign to our environment, like an immigrant grandparent whose words and concepts don't entirely fit the new world. I am a Latin, without a drop of British blood in my veins, but English is my tongue. It belongs to me as much as to any member of the House of Lords. The classics of English, Shakespeare, Milton, Pope, Keats, and Tennyson, are my classics. The myths and images of its literature are native to my imagination. And yet this rich literary past often stands at one remove from the experiential reality of the West. Our seasons, climate, landscape, natural life, and history are alien to the worldviews of both England and New England. There were no ranches or redwoods, abalone or adobe, in the Old World or the East. Spanish, not French, colors our regional accent. The world looks and feels different in California from the way it does in Massachusetts or Manchester. Not only the natural landscape, but also the urban ones. Our towns are named Sacramento and Santa Rosa, not Coventry or New Haven, There is no use listening for a nightingale in the scrub oaks and chaparral. Although the seasonal imagery of British poetry, so carefully developed over centuries from close observation of nature, has both beauty and resonance to a Californian, it seems hardly less fantastic than the wizards, fairies, and dragons who also inhabit those literary landscapes. To us, England is as exotic as Ilium or Cathay. Summers here are brown and dry, winters green and mild, and every month finds something blooming. The reality of California doesn't fit the poetic archetypes of the English tradition. Our history has no knights or kings, princesses or peers. We can muster a few broken conquistadors, but it was an army of indefatigable Franciscans who claimed California for their invisible celestial empire. Wandering through a vast, unarticulated landscape, they christened the rivers, mountains, harbors, and settlements after Catholic saints until they had exhausted the roll call of heaven. Then they borrowed Spanish words, descriptions, nicknames, even jokes, or adopted Indian terms to complete their mission. San Pedro, Sausalito, La Mirada, El Segundo, Shasta, Cotati, Topanga, and Soledad are not places one would find in Wordsworth or even Whitman. Our challenge is not only to find the right words to describe our experience, but also to discover the right images, myths, and characters. We describe a reality that has never been fully captured in English. Yet the earlier traditions of English help clarify what it is we might say. California poetry is our conversation between the past and present, out of which we articulate ourselves. I was born and raised in Hawthorne, California, a tough working-class town in southwest Los Angeles. Hawthorne was also my mother's hometown. Her mestizo father had fled his reservation in New Mexico to settle on the West Coast. My father's family had immigrated from Sicily at the turn of the century and gradually made their way west. Surrounded by Italian-speaking relations, I grew up in a neighborhood populated mostly by Mexicans and Dust Bowl Okies. I attended Catholic schools at a time when Latin was still a living ritual language. I went to Junipero Serra High School, a Catholic boys' school run by a French Marianist order, many of whom were Hawaiian, Chinese, or Mexican. The school was located in Gardena, which then contained the largest Japanese population in America, a city in which Buddhist temples outnumbered mainstream Protestant churches. Having experienced this extraordinary linguistic and cultural milieu, I have never given credence to Easterners who prattle about the intellectual vacuity of Southern California. My childhood was a rich mixture of European, Latino, Indian, Asian, and North American culture, in which everything from Hollywood to the Vatican, Buddha to the Beach Boys, had its place. My adult life is comprised equal parts of wanderlust and homesickness. My first journey, from Los Angeles to Stanford, still feels like the farthest, since I was leaving the world of working class and immigrant family for parts unknown. Since then, I have lived in Vienna, Boston, Rome, Minneapolis, New York, and now Washington. But I have always called myself a Californian, and I always knew I would return. In 1977, my girlfriend and I went to New York, planning to stay 2 years. We married, had children, and eventually remained there for nearly 2 decades. It was an exhilarating and rewarding place, but it was never truly home. In 1996, we returned to live in rural Sonoma County. Leaving for Washington 7 years later, I kept my California house. It is too easy in our society for an artist to become rootless. But I believe that it is essential for some writers to maintain their regional affinities. To speak from a particular place and time is not provincialism, but part of a writer's identity. It is my pleasure and my challenge to speak from California.
Dana Gioia, reading his essay on being a California poet from his then new collection, Disappearing Ink, Poetry at the End of Print Culture, a book he had just sent to press in 2003 when he was appointed chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, where he served in D.C. until 2009, another East Coast stint after his earlier business years in New York. Now back to our 2004 New Letters on the Air.
I went back to California a few years later. And the reason I did was that I felt that in New York, it was too easy to get caught up in the kind of public life of literature. You'd be doing panels and judging and broadcasts and board meetings and things like that. It seemed to me I was spending less and less time actually writing or reading, which to me are the two essential activities. And so I went back to California very much to have a more reclusive life, a life with greater privacy, and a life that had room for contemplation. And so I moved out to the country where I spent most of my time alone. On the average day, I saw more animals than people. And I think that's a good way for a writer to live, although it's not easy sometimes because, you know, you do get lonely or restless. But it does put you in touch with your own thoughts, your own experiences more profoundly, I think.
Yeah. And I do think that you've got to have that time to ponder things to be able to come up with something to write. Your book of essays, Disappearing Ink, Poetry at the End of Print Culture. This in some ways kind of makes a leap from Can Poetry Matter? Because one of the things that comes up here is how much our society has moved away from the printed page because there are so many other ways to get information now. Tell me what drove you to write this.
Well, Disappearing Ink, the book was really pretty much put together before I became chairman of the NEA. So I submitted the manuscript of it right before I took office. And the interesting thing is that how much of what I've learned about American culture as chairman unfortunately reinforces this. And let me see if I can give you my sense of the matter, is that we are in a society which is going through a fundamental change in how we communicate. Those of us who in the 50s saw the beginning of this change from a culture in which most information is distributed, sort of, I'll use the word read, and preserved via mechanical print, newspapers, magazines, books, pamphlets, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what was called print culture. That name was only created after it started falling apart when they're trying to describe it, because we would have back then called it culture. And of course, literary culture is about books. Now, if you go back in time far enough, there was a point, Homer is an obvious example of this, where there was a literary culture that existed before writing. And then for about somewhere around 1500 to 2000 years, there was another culture which had writing but didn't have books, didn't have mechanical printing. It was all handwriting. I've called it in this book scribal culture. And things were written out, but they were written out mainly to be read aloud. In fact, you cannot read most ancient manuscripts unless you read them aloud because they run the words together. And so the only way you can figure out what's being said is to read aloud and trust your ear. And then with Gutenberg, it became print culture and wonderful genres like the novel were created. And now we're entering something else, which is a kind of an electronic culture. Now, let me say two things that I think people often misunderstand. It is not now a matter of either or. You know, we had books, now we have electronic. What we exist right now is an interesting moment where there's about a half a dozen technologies, all of which we find necessary. You know, books, television, internet, telephones, radio, recordings, things that are kind of combination technologies like the internet and movies. And these are all things that we find necessary. And I don't think anybody wants a society where we give these things up. But what is happening, it is changing print's relationship to our culture. So what I tried to do in this book, in this essay, first and foremost, was to say, what happens to poetry in a culture which no longer uses print as the sole medium for the dissemination of poetry? The most important thing that's happened in American poetry in the last 30 years has been the revival of popular poetry. We call it rap, cowboy poetry, poetry slams, to a certain degree performance poetry, but they are our oral forms of poetry, all of which emerged outside of the official university poetry culture. If I go back to Can Poetry Matter, where I said, gee, there's something odd happening at these university writing programs because they're cut off from the rest of society. You know, I'm a working class kid. I was raised for people that weren't part of this, you know, university culture, and they liked poetry. They didn't like to read poetry, but they loved to hear it. And so what we've seen is that the people, in a sense, demanding they have poetry. Rap is the best-selling category of commercial recorded sound. So there is a demand for it. Now, I'm not saying that Snoop Dogg is the new Shakespeare. I'm not even saying that rap is great art. I'm just saying that rap incontestably is verse.
It's verse. It rhymes.
It rhymes.
Often.
It has meter.
It has meter.
You know, it has form. It has all of the figurative language that we associate with poetry. Cowboy poetry is the revival of kind of the ballad tradition, telling stories about everyday life. Poetry slams instead of auditory. And then you start to say, well, gee, suddenly even literary trends like new formalism, which is about the revival of rhyme and meter, the revival of storytelling in verse, makes sense. It's part of the populist revival of trying to connect poetry with audience. If you start taking this one step further, and the thing that gets me into trouble as a critic is I always take things one step further. You know, I want to say, well, if A, then B, then C, then D, I want to get all the way to Z. So if you start saying this, that there are in some ways two kinds of poetry that exist in the United States right now, one is spoken and the other is written, in terms of the material, I mean, it's interesting. I reprinted a rap lyric by, you know, a very famous group in a book, an anthology I did, and I wrote them for permission. They were delighted to have it reprinted, and they asked me if I would send them a copy. And I said, why? And they said, we've never seen it written down.
Oh, really? They didn't even have, I guess they don't put lyrics now
so
inside.
Well, no, but even when they develop it
orally,
the same way that Homer did. And I think that in material terms, we actually have four different kinds of poetry being written in the United States. One is oral poetry. It's poetry that's performance poetry and things like that that probably isn't even written down. It exists as oral performance. Secondly, we have a kind of poetry that's more like scribal poetry, more like the poetry that someone like Dante or Horace would have written, which is written down, revised, but is supposed to be read aloud and heard. In a populist sense, that's what cowboy poetry is. In a high literary sense, I think that's what New Formalism tried to do. Poetry as an acoustic art, an art that's spoken. Then you've got typographic poetry, which is basically, you know, it was the whole free verse revolution, which is about you arrange the language on a page so the visual arrangement is part of the expressive statement of the poem. Now, it can be read aloud too, but basically if you look at a poem by William Carlos Williams, the way that it exists visually on the page is the primary way that it's arranged, you know, language is arranged for expressive effect. Then finally, you have what used to be called concrete poetry, you know, visual poetry, where in some cases you can't even read it aloud, because if you read it aloud, you lose the thing that makes it a poem. And that these are four different schools, from the entirely visual to the entirely oral, the mainstream of poetry really being the two things in the middle.
Well, it makes it a very exciting time for us to be living in, because it's a transitional period.
I would say one other thing is that poetry was an oral art originally.
And of all the literary forms,
of all of the literary forms, poetry is perhaps the one best suited to this new secondary oral culture we're in. And that's why radio, I think, is becoming an increasingly important literary medium. One of the most interesting things in American poetry is Garrison Keillor reading a poem every day on the radio and millions of people. I was involved in a kind of debate in Poetry Magazine recently with somebody, a critic who absolutely loathes Garrison Keillor and the very ground he walks on. My taste is not the same as Garrison Keillor's, but I think he's doing an incredibly interesting thing by doing this. And in fact, my kid's sister, she's 21 years younger than me, was in the Navy, and she was on an aircraft carrier in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And this guy comes up to her and says, is your brother a poet? And she says, well, yeah. She says, well, I don't, Joy is kind of an uncommon name. And she says, yeah. And about 10 minutes later, somebody else says, is your brother a poet? And after about the third or fourth person to ask this, they said, well, we heard a poem of his on the radio today. And so somehow Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac is reaching an American aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean. And by golly, I call that outreach.
That is. Well, one of the things that I think Garrison probably shares with you is that idea of making this art form accessible. And I think that is what he's trying to do with it and showing people that it's just not an elevated thing meant for the page, that it is meant to be heard.
One thing I love about radio for poetry is that it's very intimate. It's one person speaking to one listener. Where a poetry reading can, unfortunately, sometimes approximate the atmosphere of a crowded classroom or a Sunday sermon. I don't mean to downplay the importance of civic or communal experience of poetry, but for me, the most delicious experience of poetry is when a friend will say, oh, here's a wonderful poem, let me read it to you. And it's the intimacy of communication, one voice to one listener, that is my favorite venue for poetry.
And that's why, too, I think it works with radio so much. Well, you're listening to Dana Gioia, who is the author of a book of essays called Disappearing Ink, Poetry at the End of Print Culture. And this is New Letters on the Air. What we're talking about here is only a part of what's in this book, because you cover so much ground in this book. We have a section that's on West Coast elegies. You look at the decline of San Francisco as a literary region. There's an essay on All I Have is a Voice, September 11th in American Poetry, which was a real touching essay. You deal a lot with Auden. I heard that poem on the radio so many times, September 1st.
1939.
It was a big wave that kind of took over the country, and so much of what he said was pertinent to the emotions of what was going on across the country.
With the way that that poem emerged from semi-obscurity after September 11th shows the kind of power that poetry has about how we need, in times of strife and confusion, words to express our emotions, to express our needs, and how poetry naturally is the kind of human language that best suits that.
And one of the things that I found remarkable is that I heard poetry on television, on radio, in places, not just on shows that usually have them. People were looking for a way to express what was going on, and the newscasters couldn't always come up with them.
Well, in my life, I often have gotten phone calls from strangers, and they'll say, Mr. Gioia, I've heard you are a poet. And I know what's going to come next is that they want me to recommend a poem that they might read at one of two events, either a wedding or a funeral. Because in times of great joy or unbearable grief, people need language strong enough to bear the weight of their emotion. And they instinctively turn towards poetry. And in terms of national crisis, that's true too.
Well, let's have a little taste of your poetry. Interrogations at Noon is your book of poetry from 2001, and it was the winner of the American Book Award in 2002. You start out with a wonderful poem that is not the title poem of the book. It's called Words, and I think in some ways it probably sums up your view.
Well, it is, it's a, you know, God help us, it's a philosophical poem, and it's about what language can do and what language can't do. Words. The world does not need words. It articulates itself in sunlight, leaves, and shadows. The stones on the path are no less real for lying uncatalogued and uncounted. The fluent leaves speak only the dialect of pure being. The kiss is still fully itself, though no words were spoken. And one word transforms it into something less or other. Illicit, chaste, perfunctory, conjugal, covert. Even calling it a kiss betrays the fluster of hands glancing the skin or gripping a shoulder, the slow arching of neck or knee, the silent touching of tongues. Yet the stones remain less real to those who cannot name them or read the mute syllables graven in silica. To see a red stone is less than seeing it as jasper, metamorphic quartz, cousin to the flint the Kiowa carved as arrowheads. To name is to know and to remember. The sunlight needs no praise, piercing the rain clouds, painting the rocks and leaves with light, then dissolving each lucent droplet back into the clouds that engendered it. The daylight needs no praise, and so we praise it always, greater than ourselves and all the airy words we summon.
Words, the opening poem from the book Interrogations at Noon by Dana Gioia. The book covers so many things. There are a lot of personal, really lovely things. The image of you watching your wife who seems unaware of you, or the narrator in the story, not necessarily you. It was such a lovely image. And then there's a line that opens one of your poems that I think captures a lot of what's going on in this book. It goes, this is a litany of lost things. And I felt like there were a lot of litanies in here. That was a good way to put it, of lost things, of things that might have been, had you taken that different path. It's a yearning. There's a lot of yearning in this book.
You know, I think one of the things that poetry does best is either to try to preserve something that seems so invaluable that it breaks your heart to see it perish, to see it slip away, or to explore some unlived possibility in life that, unless you articulate it, unless you explore it, will, as it were, go unsaid. So it's both to save and to create.
I think that's true. That's what gives it its power, too. I have to ask you one quick question. What is it that shifted you from wanting to be a composer to wanting to be a poet?
My early training was in music. You know, because if you're a poor kid in this country, you don't really get any serious training in the arts except music. I mean, that's really about the only art that a lot of early instruction and performance possibilities are available to you. I love music. It's still perhaps my favorite art. But at the same time, I saw the limits of my own talent as a musician, and I became more and more interested in poetry, about the things you could say more explicitly in poetry with words and literary language than you could simply with sounds. But what I like to think is that a lot of my training as a musician was enormously helpful to me as a poet, because poetry is the art of using language to move through time. Music is about sounds moving through time.
It also explains your attraction for metered rhyme and form in that way.
Exactly. You know, I write both in free verse and in form, and I've never understood why those two things should be mutually exclusive. I
mean, well, they shouldn't.
There's huge, you know, huge poetry wars of the 80s and 90s about that. But it seems to me a smart poet tries to use all of the techniques that are available. But even when I write free verse, I think my free verse is kind of noisier and more musical maybe than some people, because I just love the kind of sounds you can make in free verse. The kind of, I mean, what's freedom for if it's not for some kind of jubilation?
That's so true. Well, let's have you read the last poem from this book.
Okay. Interrogations at Noon starts with a poem called Words, about the limits and possibilities of language. And it ends with a very short poem called Unsaid, which is about how much of our own existence, how much of our lives is unknowable to anyone else because it's entirely private. Unsaid. So much of what we live goes on inside. The diaries of grief, the tongue-tied aches of unacknowledged love, are no less real for having passed unsaid. What we conceal is always more than what we dare confide. Think of the letters that we write our dead.
Unsaid, the final poem of Interrogations at Noon, winner of the 2002 American Book Award. Dana Gioia's new works include the 2018 Poets Prize winner, 99 Poems, and another essay book, The Catholic Writer Today, as well as his libretto for the one-act dance opera Haunted and a jazz collaboration, Sung with Words. The California Poet Laureate from 2015 through 18 eagerly awaits the next poet's appointment. For links, go to newletters.org. There's also a Support New Letters button in the top right corner for donations. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was originally produced with Alex Smith, Eric Motter, Catherine Poliai, and Dennis Conroe, with updates by Anna Stokes and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.